It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello, breathe deep and relax. No longer do you have to worry about the javelin, the single sculls, or indeed the test match, because the greatest game on earth is back and it's time to talk football. I'm Gabriel Marcotti and I'm here to discuss a fascinating, high-scoring first weekend of the season. Aren't first weekends always fascinating? This week I am joined by Rory Smith, Tony Cascarino, and from beautiful downtown Rippendon, it's Ollie Kay. Later on, we're going to be discussing what the Premier League clubs need to do to keep the flame alive and banish all Olympic metaphors forever. But let's start with the champions. City and Southampton, Ollie Kay, you were there. Why can't City hold the lead?
I think they got careless, as against QPR on the final day of last season. I thought they just lost their way, having missed a few chances early in the second half. They ended up conceding two goals in very quick succession, very well punished by Southampton. But I don't think it's something that they particularly had a reputation for doing last season. I think it's sort of like it was late season nerves against QPR last season, and then I think yesterday was probably early season rustiness.
Rory, are you satisfied with Ollie's answer? I ask him why, and he just says they lost their way.
I think he's right. I think they thought it was going to be a lot easier than it turned out to be, and then Lambert comes on, changes it. Stephen Davis, who I think is going to be one of the signings of the season, gave Southampton more rhythm, gave them a bit of hold in midfield, and City looked. It was a slapdash performance, and the one thing I would say is that it's probably quite a good slapdash performance from Roberto Mancini's point of view, because it means they might go and spend some money.
Cass, is that what they need to do? Go and spend money?
You think it was
Mancini's master plan? Let's go and struggle a bit against Southampton so that we can go and spend more money?
No, well, let's put it in perspective. Southampton tried to frustrate, and for an hour they didn't create anything against Man City. They fell behind, and from that moment they fell behind. As Rory said, Ricky Lambert came on and they made a couple of individual mistakes, City, that cost them dearly. They only had, two or three chances during the game. They were all in the latter stages of the match against Man City, and they got punished every time. Joe Hart was left, really with no chance with both goals. And they were well taken. I thought City still showed an immense amount of character like we've seen before to go on and win a game that they could easily have drawn and probably unlikely lose, but they showed character in abundance for me.
Ollie, I was one of those people kind of assumed that City would be better this season, regardless of their signings, because I thought that Aguero and Silva would have another season under their belt. I thought that Carlos Tevez looked motivated in preseason, and certainly I thought played very well against Southampton, and that Mario Balotelli could kind of realize that, hey, if he behaves and acts normal for 1 month, then he's actually potentially could be living up to his reputation, to his good reputation. But then I see this, and I'm asking myself, why didn't they wipe the floor with Southampton? And are City good enough the way they are now to go and win again, or do they actually need to strengthen?
I don't think it's a case of them needing to strengthen to sort of correct weaknesses in their squad. I think their squad is very strong, but maybe a little bit short in certain areas, despite all the money that they've spent.
Which ones?
Well, I always think they lack central defensive cover, but I always feel that one thing that they do need is a genuine wide player, even if it's just to come off the bench as an option. I know people will say Adam Johnson, but he's a left footer that likes playing on the right hand side. I mean a very orthodox winger that could just give them something slightly different at times. But sorry,
if I can jump in there on Adam Johnson, and this is a new feature this year on the podcast, which I discussed with our producer Chris Skinner before. Instant poll: Adam Johnson, right or wrong for City? And then we'll go right back to Ollie. Rory K.
No and no.
Cass?
Yeah, I think he's got a future. I think he's very hit and miss, but at clubs sometimes you need the unpredictable, and he's that type of player.
All right, all the opinions divided. Pick it up where you left off.
No, I don't think he's got a future there, and I think for his own benefit, more than City's, I think he should move on.
Something else, we talked about the defensive cover. I mean, I know they went for Daniel Agger in the summer. That didn't quite work out, may yet work out. I mean, I spoke to somebody who felt that basically the issue with Marwood was he wants value now, and so they go and they bid a lot less than they expect and figure we'll slowly converge towards the middle, but hasn't been much convergence as of yet. They've been linked with De Rossi, and by the time you listen to this podcast, we might know more. He's doing a press conference on Tuesday. Now, what strikes me about this, Rory, is while I absolutely adore Daniele De Rossi, he's not really the answer in central defense. I mean, he played two games there at the Euros. I don't know that he's fast enough to play as a central defender. But more to the point, the guy makes an enormous amount of money. The guy is Roma through and through. The guy will only leave Roma if Roma kind of say, hey, it's really, would be really, if you really love the club, you'll leave because we'll, you know, cash in. So he's going to want an enormous bump to do that. He makes 6 million euros a year net, which works out to in the region of 180 grand a week. There's reports that you need to bump up to 9 million euros a year net, which I make 270 grand a week, which I believe would make him the highest paid player in the Premier League. And that's without considering a transfer fee, which would be, you know, in sort of, you know, the 25 million pound range for a guy who's not Van Persie, as great as he is. Is this kind of insane? Is Mancini just barking up the wrong tree?
I think what's happened with City is, rightly or wrongly, but certainly admirably, this summer they've tried to cut back on the spending, as you say, and that's largely because they're frightened of financial fair play and they want to be seen to be sort of obeying the laws when they come in, which is fine. That's meant that they've had to sell to buy, but they've not sold anyone because everyone knows that at some point late in August they'll be desperate to offload Dzeko and they'll accept a lower fee, so all the buying clubs wait. At the same time, the teams that they want to buy players for, like Liverpool, as you say, there's no convergence. That Liverpool said, right, well, we want 27 million quid for Daniel Agger. And City have he's the right signing, Agger, for City. He'd do brilliantly there. He's just the player they need. But City have said, well, that's not value for money, so we're not going to pay it. Liverpool, because it's City, and they know that at some point they'll get desperate, are saying, right, well, we still want 27 million quid for Daniel Agger. Come back when you want him. And now Mancini's frustrated, and he's panicking a little bit because you're absolutely right. City don't need players, but they need to keep moving forward. If you don't move forward in football, if you stand still, you fall backwards. So I think De Rossi's the right signing for City in midfield, not in defence. I think he's a good... Their central midfield lacks something. There's Yaya, Rodwell's sort of okay, but they could do with another world-class midfielder, so I'd see why they want De Rossi.
Not at those numbers, though.
Not for 270 grand a week. No, that's ridiculous. But if that's what it costs, then you have to pay it. And that's City have backed themselves into a corner.
See, one thing that happens at football clubs, and especially if you're successful, Gab, as we all know, is that not only are you looking to bring in players who would be very expensive, like De Rossi, that you give new contracts to guys who have proved very worthy. You know, someone like Kompany, who's just signed a new deal, a mega deal.
Aguero.
Yeah, so many of them will sign big new deals. So financial play becomes even more apparent that you have to, you know, keep in line, and you've given all these new deals out as well. So it's not only the expenditure of buying in new players, it's the existing ones that you want to reward for your success.
Ollie, as I understand, Rippenden is closer to Eastlands than from where we're speaking from, and you were there around those people yesterday. In light of what Cass just said, do you get a sense that they get it? That I mean, I don't understand, as we said, De Rossi if you're going to give him 270 or even 250, next thing that happens is Sergio Aguero's going to come out and say, hey, I think I'm slightly better than De Rossi and more important to this team, and probably is. And then you got to go pay him. And does Mancini, I mean, I can see the Marwood argument, but does Mancini not get it? Did he address this at all yesterday? Anybody think to ask him?
He's been asked about the sort of transfer impasse, a few times in recent weeks, and he generally sort of replies sort of slightly witheringly. You need to ask Brian Marwood about that.
And do people ask Brian Marwood, or does he just sit in a box and not speak to anyone?
I think people have lines of communication into the boardroom and back out again. But Brian Marwood certainly hasn't spoken on the record about it. Recently, so we've had no official answers from there. But it's similar, really, to how when Chelsea first started winning league, and then they spent a lot to try and keep building, and Shevchenko and Balak and so on, and then they went into this sort of more rationalised period where they were trying to rationalise their spending and really restrict, and Abramovich was sort of turning the tap off, and it seems like City are trying to do that. Obviously, there's the financial fair play difficulties as well. But it must be very strange for City to be, and strange for Mancini to want a player like Van Persie and want a player like Javi Martinez and not be able to get them, seemingly not be able to get them because the money isn't there. I think Mancini must find it very frustrating because, you would say that had he been able to add Van Persie rather than United, I think Van Persie, I think we'd be talking about a one-horse race for the title.
The parallel with Chelsea, obviously, is an apt one. And I think if you take 2006 as being the point at which they stopped adding really expensive players to their squad, there was a plateauing of their success, wasn't there, for 4 years?
Until they got an Italian manager, then they started winning again.
Arguably the greatest manager of all time in Carlo Ancelotti.
And
a warrior of the light, like Carlo Ancelotti. This isn't sort of disparaging their achievement under Di Matteo at all, but that the Champions League was kind of the last hurrah of that generation, that first team that Mourinho built, and that kind of spoke back to 2005. But City want to avoid that. City want to keep growing, but they're being held back by the lavish spending of 3 years ago, and that's the problem.
Well, don't get me wrong, but aren't Chelsea the biggest spenders this summer?
That's fine. They've decided to start spending again.
And then you go back to Torres when he signed. They spent 70 million in that window in January.
That's only
18 months.
No, I agree. And that's a whole other issue. And that's one of the mysteries of Chelsea, which is a discussion for another time. But guys, I wanted to ask you, because I want to talk a bit about Southampton. I know that Alan Pardew doesn't like their chairman, but I've spent some time with him, and I think he's certainly very sure of himself. But I think they've obviously, had a good setup. They came up. What struck me about Atkins is he plays a 17-year-old kid in midfield. Now, I haven't picked up your biography of late, but can you give us a bit of context about, I'm assuming, were you 17 when you made your debut?
19.
You can tell me you were 11 or something.
19.
No. What's it like, and what do you think, and how are you different at 17 to 19? Can you just take us there a little bit about, I mean, you're like, Craigie, I'm playing in my Premier League debut against the champions. I am 17 years old. That's David Silva. That's Sergio Aguero.
Well, there is a safeguard to that, Gab, is that, I remember when Damien Duff and Robbie Keane came into the Ireland squad at 17-year-old kids, and the naivety of, these players, that they can be fearless, and they can walk into a football match and actually embrace it. It's not, the fear doesn't come within them on them particular days. For them, they're in a dream world. It's an opportunity, and I think they just totally don't know what's going to be in front of them. Years down the line, you do look back, and you sometimes, with experience, you do feel more pressure in some ways. But find people in the deep end can be an unbelievable asset for you, because they can just go out and think, do you know what? I've got nothing to prove. I'm a 17-year-old kid. I'm just going to want to play football. And they can achieve. And I've seen many, many kids being thrown in the deep end and be successful. And you'll find out that they will be good enough if they can show immediately what a manager's confidence of what he's seen in training, he looks at the guy's character. You know, you take all this into consideration. Nigel Atkinson wouldn't have just thrown him in. He would have known that, I'll tell you what, this kid can be ready now. He looks like he's ready. He can handle it. I'm sure he can. He'd have been convinced by that.
Ollie, you were there. I'm assuming, given that the Premier League so media-friendly, he was made available to the media afterwards, and you got a lot of time with him. What's he like?
Well, I can only judge him as a player. He was very, he's very tidy, very mature in what he did on the ball, and mature and sensible in what he did off the ball. I thought he looked like a very decent player, but I was interested to note beforehand that his father's a barrister. I don't know what to say to that, but yeah, it's not a typical football
background. A
minor,
a barrister.
Well, this goes back to our discussion about class and people playing football.
This is the
maybe
year.
Times are changing.
This is the year of the double-barreled surname. If you look at Fraser Price and who was the other Jamaican lady sprinter who in the Olympics.
Okay, a lot of lady sprinters have double-barreled surnames because they get married. A. B. Let's not go back to the Olympics. C. Not a woman and he's not
Ward
a sprinter.
Prowls. There's loads
D.
Of...
Even just because you have a double-barreled surname does not mean that you are posh.
It does if your dad's Sean a barrister.
Sean Wright Phillips.
Very posh. Love the words of Prowls.
Colin Richards.
Colin Kazim Richards.
Debut for Blackburn.
Colin Kazim Richards is a massive fan of ballet. He's extraordinarily pop.
Colin Kazim Richards is now Colin Kazim, of course.
Kazim
but
Richards.
That's another issue. Roy, you wrap this up. Since you live closer to Southampton than any of us.
That's true, yeah.
Thank you. Your assessment on, it's early, but what they did over the summer, the way they spent their money, and I kind of reckon after last year, if you approach with a certain kind of fearlessness, if you play a certain type of football, we've kind of seen that, like, you have a decent chance of staying up.
This is my season debut on the game, because obviously I joined the Times after the season started. So my general theory in football is that there are 14 rubbish teams in the Premier League, and the teams that come up aren't a vast amount worse than them. That was proven last year. Something like only three of the last 12 teams to come up, only three have gone down that first season. That is overstated. I think Southampton have bought well in Stephen Davis and Nathaniel Clyne. I'm not so sure about Jay Rodriguez. I think that was a lot of money. But if they get Gaston Ramirez from Bologna, who looks extraordinarily good, I think that could give them the real impetus to sort of stay up.
You know, he only likes Gaston Ramirez because he's Uruguayan, right?
Absolutely.
Just to be clear on that.
But Stephen Davis is, for me, a superb signing. He really is.
What did they pay there? 100,000, was it? It's quite reasonable.
Yeah, obviously picking the carcass of Rangers. But I think Davis it's baffled me why Premier League club didn't pick him up sooner.
I was really dying to know, but that if Rory K. Smith says that there are 14 rubbish teams in the Premier League, you assume last year's top four are not rubbish teams. So then I wonder, and Chelsea are the European champions, so presumably they're not rubbish teams. So I wonder who the other rubbish team is, whether it's Newcastle.
Newcastle aren't rubbish.
Newcastle are not rubbish. So that would mean that either Liverpool, Liverpool are rubbish, yeah?
Liverpool last season were rubbish, yeah.
This paper has such an anti-Liverpool bias, I cannot take it.
I tell you what, that's maybe a bit harsh on Everton. Actually, Everton weren't rubbish last year.
I don't look at the Premier League and see rubbish teams.
Thank you, Mr.
Scudamore. To suggest it's hard to see a team that that you think will struggle. I mean, I was
rubbish is maybe stretching it, Ollie, and I do apologise, but no, I think that there isn't the gap between the top of the Championship and the mid table in the Premier League is a lot smaller than everyone says.
I would tend to agree with that, I agree with both of them. I think for that reason, I think what we should have is a six team Super League playing each other all the time, and then have like a giant amorphous, perhaps. A 30-team league, taking the other 14 teams in the Premier League and taking the top 16 times sides from the Championship, and they could go play and people could tell us how rubbish the Big Six Super League is. Yeah?
Yeah.
Good deal? All right, Arsenal and Sunderland. Before we get into the game, I don't subscribe to the, people know, to the Moneyball approach. It seems to me that getting £24 million for a guy who is 29 years old and who, until, what, a year and a half ago, had missed more than half of his team's Premier League starts is actually a very good deal, especially when he has 1 year left on his contract. Anybody want to argue that Arsenal should have paid him the same amount of money that United did and not sold him?
Yeah, I think by the time he had refused to sign a new contract, and by the time he'd gone to Wenger and said, I want to play for Man United and my head's not here anymore, I think it was pretty impossible for Arsenal to resist. And I'm actually amazed that they managed to get as good a price as they were, as they did, 24 million. But that's the price they got, but we don't know the price that they will pay for being without him. It's a big loss for their team.
24 million is not a lot of money now, is it?
It is for a guy who's 29 years old and has no resale value,
Gab,
and is on enormous wages.
No, Gab. Sir Alex Ferguson is in his early 70s, and there will be a time, it's coming soon, of him finishing at Old Trafford. He's just lost the Premiership last year. He's looking at a 29-year-old who he thinks will make a massive impact at Old Trafford, who is, when he's fit, and rightly so, he has missed a lot of football, is as good as anybody at scoring goals and will be creative, and he can play in many different styles of play. And I think he thinks he can win the league with this guy. And that's why he's paid so much for him. He's looking at him thinking, I want the title back. Fergie's a stubborn man. We know that. He's a guy that absolutely wants to get. He paid $30 million for Berbatov when he was, 28?
27,
28. You know, he paid 30 for a guy.
Was that money well spent?
Well, it didn't prove to be that way, but he still got a good return from Berbatov.
Well, how is it a good return? Goal in three, Tevez leaves the club because Berbatov is there?
It wasn't a bad signing, Gab. Sometimes you have to do short-term signings that, you know, a guy at 29, you might get 2 years out. You know, he's trying to give the club the best chance of winning the Premiership, Champions League. That's what he's trying to do.
Roy, you're always going on about numbers, and so... Very simple. The guy is going to make £40 million over the next 4 years. He costs £24 million in transfer fees, assuming he doesn't get hurt or anything. So that works out to about £16 million a year. Is he going to add £16 million? Looking at it, putting my Glazer hat on, is he going to add £16 million in revenue a season?
I wouldn't have thought so, because United's revenues would be so high. But
advantage Marcotti.
I've got to admit, I think, at the risk of introducing a sort of quieter consensus to this conversation, I think my reading of the situation, Ollie will know a lot more than I do, is that Ferdy might have spent more this summer, which means that next summer he has to spend less if he's still there. And that's where I think the idea that maybe this is his final shot of glory comes from. I agree with Cass. I don't think 24 million quid is going to make a hill of beans to United when it comes to meeting the debt. I just don't think the company's far too big for that.
Ollie, educate us.
I wish I could, but I mean, we started off this by talking about Arsenal.
Yeah, I know. I thought Arsenal sold very well.
I was going to say that, you know, although it is a good price for a guy who's 29 and has had injuries in the past and was in the final year of his contract and wasn't going to renew it, what are Arsenal going to do with the money? It's fine saying it's a good price, but if they don't spend, and if they don't replace and they don't strengthen, then it's not a good deal at all for them.
Can I just say, this is why Ollie is the number one, right? We're supposed to talk about Arsenal and Sunderland here. Cass and I being silly people of silly Italian extraction, well, at least one of us, we come out and we digress and talk about United and Fergie. We're supposed to talk about Arsenal and Sunderland, and Kay, being the consummate professional, takes us back to what we're supposed to talk about. So let's...
I only did that because you said educate us.
No, exactly. And you
have nowhere to go on.
I'm being serious. This is why you're the number one.
Okay.
There is one other issue in terms of Arsenal that Ollie's absolutely
Thank you.
Right.
Stick with Arsenal.
Transfers don't exist in isolation. Van Persie's a good sale if Arsenal go out and spend that 24 million quid.
All right,
quid
well, let's Fernando talk about Llorente. What this... Well, forget Fernando Llorente. Wait, they're about Olivier Giroud. They're not going to sign Giroud and Llorente.
Two points to make. One is that apparently they're not going to buy another striker. The theory is that they'll bring in Nuri Sahin on loan from Real Madrid, and they might go for a defensive midfielder. Which
us Euro snobs call him Shaheen, by the way.
You can call him what you like. I call him Nuri Sahin. The other thing that I think that really needs sorting at Arsenal is the contract policy. There's a lot made of their transfer policy about the way Wenger buys. Arsenal cannot let this happen again, where a player gets down to 2 years on a contract and then refuses to sign another one. They've got to throw it back a year and sell and say to players with 3 years left, you're signing.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
And in a longer-term extension. That's what Newcastle did.
Oh, they gave that big, long contract to Alex Song, and of course he left for Barcelona.
I think that's a different situation, Song, and also that is definitely a good price.
Some people really like Alex Song. Cass, on the game itself, I thought Cazorla was fantastic. A lot of us did. I think he's a tremendous signing at that price. Giroud, I view a bit differently. He's more of a gamble. Simply because this is such an unorthodox player in terms of his development. 2 years ago, he was playing in the second division and not really playing much or well at all because he was at university. Imagine that, wasting his time studying instead of playing professional football. And Podolski, I'm not a Podolski guy at all. No. So can these guys, between the three of them, make up for Van Persie?
There's a few points. I think the lad, Giroud, there's a lot of, obviously, emphasis on him to do well. I think a little bit unfair. You know, it's a massive jump from Montpellier to come to, from the French league to Arsenal. I thought they played okay. They created, give credit to Sunderland, the way they defended it was everybody behind the ball, apart from one effort early on in the game from James McLean. Sunderland were just backpedalling, getting numbers, frustrated Arsenal. But that's what Arsenal have had to deal with over the last few seasons. And they always had the guy that could produce a bit of magic.
On Sunderland, Steve Bruce left. They did fantastic under O'Neill. Then they seemed to run out of gas at the end of the season. They haven't made too many signings as of right now. What's the plan there? Do you think? I mean, O'Neill says there's more guys coming in. Do you think he's happy with where he is?
Well, I mean, just returning to Adam Johnson, he's one that they're very keen on it and are trying to talk to City about, and fairly hopeful that they can get a deal for him, and unless somebody else comes in with a better offer a better offer for him. I think he would give them something that they don't have, but I think their real priority has to be a striker who's going to get them goals. I mean, Sahar is an excellent player, but he's rarely fit. They had Sessegnon sort of leading the line on his own, and he's a really good player, but not a striker. They've got Connor Wickham, who moved there for big money a year ago and hasn't really developed yet. Looks like he would probably be better off going out on loan somewhere. And I don't know who this striker is that's going to get them the goals, because defensively they look good, but they need a striker who's going to be able to turn them from a mid-table team into a team that can maybe sort of challenge with the likes of Everton and Liverpool.
A striker, Rory? How old is Henrik Larsson's son? I mean, he must be...
Stephen Fletcher is the best British natural goal scorer that is currently playing professional football at the level that Sunderland could get. So O'Neill has to really push the boat out to get Fletcher. I know the price Wolves want is ludicrous, but Fletcher will score your goals. His chance conversion ratio in poor sides is incredible.
Are they talking for him? 15 million?
Yeah, I think 15, but I think a lot of it's clauses. But Wolves want a lot of money. I suspect that might diminish as the window goes down. But Fletcher is the sort of player he'd fit right in at that Sunderland side.
You pay incredibly over the odds for British players. It's amazing.
So why sign them?
No. Well, I totally agree.
But O'Neill often signs players from abroad, of course.
Tony said in Monday's paper, quite rightly, that Mitchell...
Which Tony? We've got two
Tony Castorino.
There, so. Thank you.
Former Nancy hitman, right. Tony Castorino.
My boss is also named Tony, as you know.
Said in today in Monday's paper that Mitchell tossed £2 million after scoring $15 in La Liga. The price on British players is ridiculous, but Fletcher is a very, very good striker.
To be fair, though, you foreigners can often let you down and you don't really know
just don't get
to
it.
Trust. So, but... All right, our debate this week, we're going to be looking at it. Why can't footballers be more like Olympians? Why can't footballers be more like Matthew Syed? And why can't they be nice and role models and inspire a generation? No, just kidding. We won't be doing that. But we will be talking about, I think it's impossible not to. Those of us who are Londoners, of course, we've had these Olympic Games, which were, I think, universally positively received. I want to throw something out there. Certainly, there's a mood, and I mean, even Scudamore, when he did his sort of two-hour infomercial on Sky Sports News, was asked about it and had to address it. We've had this thrilling end to last season. The Premier League voted it the greatest in the 20 years, which I thought was ridiculous, given a lot of the off-the-pitch ugliness that we saw, and also some of the not-so-good football. But that said, is there something – I mean, is it inevitable that we juxtapose these Olympic Games with the Premier League? Is there something that we've learned that could increase our enjoyment of football and just simply make football better? Ollie?
I think it's inevitable. And I think there are certainly things that football could learn in terms of
what are they?
The spirit that the game is played in, the spirit in which the game is watched, but –
what,
at the same time,
biased judges helping the hometown athlete, that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, exactly. There is a danger that where people only look at what was good about the Olympics and only look at what is bad about football. The Olympics was brilliant; it was fantastically successful. I enjoyed it immensely. There really are obvious things that we can look at and say, wouldn't it be better if football was like that? But it's almost like comparing apples and oranges. There are significant differences in the way football is played, in the spirit in which it's played, in the spirit in which it's watched. And although we can all say, wouldn't it be nicer if it was like that? It's not exactly easy to say, right, let's make all football stadiums lovely and friendly and there be no hostility, because a lot of the time the hostility, when it doesn't go overboard, is brilliant. The passion and rawness and intensity of a football stadium is preferable to me to the sort of flag waving jingoism of a rowing crowd at Eton Dorney. But there are obvious things to learn, but it's not exactly easy to implement that.
Right.
Yeah, I think we have to separate the idea of whether football should be more like the Olympics, because obviously it's a sport. So if you look at the sporting activity, there's an element of, you know, should players not dive and cheat and blah 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 blah. But then if you look at Mo Farah's 10,000 meter, you see the Ethiopians pushing and not sort of grouping Ethiopians as some sort of as bullies, but the Ethiopians and the Kenyans in distance running runners gangs, like they're not running sportingly. There was the whole badminton thing. It's
so
more,
isn't that teamwork?
Is it all right? Then is it teamwork to, you know, is it? But
is it
you're
teamwork
trying
to build
win?
An indoor track, cycling track that's purpose built for one guy and go and win a whole bunch of medals and tell us how great you are.
Gab, this is exactly it. That we're not talking about the sport itself but so much. We're talking about the experience
exactly.
around the
so,
sport, and that is a circle. And it doesn't just involve the sport; it involves the media that present the sport and the fans that absorb that media and absorb the sport.
Well,
and the difference here is that in the Olympics, anything that was negative was ignored. The seat thing kind of came for a couple of days. It was not. I enjoyed the Olympics, loved it, every second of it, but it was not far off propaganda. Whereas with football, people concentrate on the negative. What football can learn from the Olympics is that maybe if the media themselves present a slightly more positive face, not that propagandistic face that we got with the Olympics, because that's John Inverdale crying when Mark Hunter and Zach Purchase come off the lake. That's not what the media are there to do. You're not there to flag wave and to cheer people
on. What about that guy who kept hugging everybody? Who is that? That guy who came on TV dressed like a slop? What's his name?
Phil.
Skinner knows, yeah?
Handy Phil.
Who is that guy?
He's the British hugging champion. He's employed to touch athletes. A bit like Purple Atty in Liverpool.
You're saying basically that we felt good about it because everybody emphasised a lot of the positives.
Yeah, the Olympics show the country as we want to be. The football is what this country is.
But was
is.
That because, mm. I'm going to throw this out there, was that because this ultimately was a short-term exercise?
Yeah.
And so there was no reason not to emphasise the positives.
It's a holiday fling where everything's perfect, whereas football is the drudgery of married life. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. There you go. That's an analogy.
It felt like the fans were the athletes to me. Because we're talking about comparing footballers like Mo or, you know, and the great guys are giving up. You know a lot of footballers, Gab. Rory knows a lot of footballers, and so do Ollie. I presume you do too.
Of course I do.
And would you say, in generalising, that there's that many bad footballers?
No.
So we're talking about athletes as they're on a pedestal. Yes, they were fantastic. I absolutely admire. But also, you don't get the media. No one was having a go at Mo Farah. When you're on a football pitch and you're not doing well, if you're having a go at an athlete and everyone booing him or cheering, you know, football is full of controversy, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and also
on that point though, I want to throw something out because it really struck me, and I thought was a bit different about the way the media, including this newspaper, covered certain things. When there were certain athletes, British or otherwise, who were among their favorites. And in Italy, we had this swimmer named Federica Pellegrini, who's blonde and attractive and very good. And she had a very bad Olympics. Mm. And there was inquests, and what did this go wrong? You know, our rowing coach was, you know, one of our top rowers demanded that he resign afterwards because they didn't do as well as they wanted, blah, blah, blah. Here, you know, you had a situation where I thought the women's football team was terrible. I mean, I thought they were. I think this has been an ongoing issue. Mm-hmm. Good players. I don't think Hope Powell is particularly good. And just play badly, and they lose, and they go out. I expect, if you're going to treat the sport seriously, to look at it seriously and say, like, why did this happen? In the same way that, you know, had Murray gone out straight away, like, hey, you're supposed to be really good. Why did this happen? Or Rebecca Adlington, is it in the swimming as well? You know, like, yeah, I know everybody else improved, but you know, did something go wrong? It seems to me that people don't really treat this way. You know, it's kind of like, oh, look, you know, these guys screwed up. They didn't. Oh, but they're still wonderful. Well, the women's field hockey team's still wonderful. I mean, if we're going to I think there's a bit of a disconnect there, right? Because in football, in cricket, in the sports that we cover regularly, if people try really hard and work really hard and have a lot of passion for what they do, but they lose when they're supposed to win, they will be criticised.
Well, that's because the basic assumption with all sport is that you're trying really hard. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of a story if you get a cricketer or a footballer who goes out and, to be honest, doesn't really care. Just, I'm not trying that hard to do this. We should assume that. But in the Olympics, it seems to be that that's all that matters. So you get the swimming's the best parallel, because the swimming was the one area that underperformed. And even then, swimmers were coming out of the pool, British swimmers, and Sharon Davis wasn't saying, did you mistime your, did you get your start wrong? Did you mistime your sort of your kick? I don't want to sort of criticise journalists who are a lot better than me, but I think there was a lot.
Were all the journalists who were better than you, were they actually saying everybody's wonderful?
I didn't see a single inquest piece or anyone saying this didn't go right. Maybe a little bit after Cavendish lost the road or didn't win the road race, that there was a slight sort of element of what went wrong. But there was the whole negativity has not been welcome in this country during the Olympics.
I guarantee there'll be one person would be brave enough to even criticise any athlete that was successful. I don't mean just for winning something. I mean where they look at footballers. You can win some things in football and they'll still look for angles to try and criticise you. That's what footballers don't trust. The media, they don't trust the general public. It's because they deal with, on a regular basis, that the top players will have stuff that's negative towards them. So now they're in fear of what they say. So it's a very unfair comparison because, like I said before, we all know footballers and a lot of decent guys in there as well.
Ollie, you get the final word on this. Again, to counteract what we were talking about earlier, I have to say, like, I watched the men's, I guess it was a super heavyweight final, just because there was an Italian guy in it, Camarelli, and he was up against a British guy, Anthony Joshua, who, you know, I'm biased here. I thought Camarelli had him beat. I wasn't as bad as Roy Jones Jr., but I think there was, you know, probably an element of home field advantage. But I thought the boxing media, actually, in this country, we're pretty straight up about that. They said, like, wow, you know, well done, Anthony Joshua, but he could have easily lost his fight because the other guy was better. So I actually saw honesty there. Was that an isolated case?
I thought there was probably, I mean, it's probably the one sport, well, one of the very few sports where it comes down to something relatively subjective, like a judge. I mean, obviously, there's the diving. You know, did Tom Daley get the odd preferential call or anything like that. I don't know. I don't have the technical knowledge of diving to have a clue about that.
Skinner, but, can I just tell you, Ollie Skinner shaking his head. Skinner, of course, was a competitive diver when he was younger. So I'm assuming that joking. Tom Daly did not get any advantage. Skinner's the producer. He's not allowed to talk. Continue, Ollie.
Okay, but since you said I could have the final word, I'm going to change it onto a slightly different final word and say that people just see what they want to see. When as a British Olympian, and they talk after a game, after a football match, after a boxing fight, after a race or whatever, people want to love them. They want to like them. And the point I made during the Olympics was that if somebody saw Wayne Rooney, Wayne Rooney was a 26-year-old from Liverpool who was boxing in the Olympics, and he spoke after winning a bronze medal or whatever, people would think, God, isn't he nice? Isn't he down to earth? Isn't he a lovely guy? Now, I'm not saying Wayne Rooney is a lovely guy. We've seen him rage on the football pitch. We've seen the odd other thing, but he is essentially a nice guy, a nice down to earth guy. But people, when they're football fans, people think, oh, he's just horrible. They see what they want to see. People have conceptions about all these footballers, particularly the sort of high-profile English footballers. People don't want to like them unless it suits them to sort of revere them because it's their club. And I think the thing that people have to realise is that generally these guys are good guys, and these guys have worked incredibly hard to get where they are. Frank Lampard, for example, he has worked exceptionally hard, and yet people will sort of view him in a different way because he's part of a Chelsea team that isn't widely liked. There are obviously exceptions, and there's obviously a scrutiny where people get criticised in the media or get the worst elements of their life get covered all over the media. But most of these guys are decent guys and very admirable sportsmen.
All right, time now for some quick hits. Liverpool lose 3-0 at West Brom, and Brendan Rodgers says that there will be more days like this. Rory, in the name of Liverpool fans, like our boss, Tony Evans, we all hope it's wrong, of course. But what was the problem at the Hawthorns, and is Rodgers really the guy to fix it?
I think Rodgers is the guy to fix it. He will need time. I suspect there will be a few more bumps along the road. I think the problem is that Liverpool don't necessarily have the players to play the way that Rodgers wants to play. This isn't going to be popular, but I think Steven Gerrard doesn't fit into that system at all. He's 32. I would suggest that there will come a point this season or next when Brendan Rodgers has to make a very difficult decision. It will be rough. Liverpool won't finish in the top four this season, I don't think, unless they spend a significant amount of money between now and the end of August. There will be difficult times ahead.
It's funny, I thought they were passing side under Kenny Dalglish and they're passing side now. But hey, let's take Steven Gerrard out back and shoot him. They shoot horses, don't they? Chelsea go 2-0 up early against Wigan and then see out the match with Eden Hazard showing he is, in fact, a bit special. Ollie, some say Fernando Torres underachieved last year because there were other big-name strikers around and he didn't feel sure of a starting spot. Now his competition consists of precisely of one guy, Daniel Sturridge, and he had meningitis. It was meningitis, wasn't it? Mm. There you go. Does this mean Chelsea don't need to buy another striker? And what would Ollie Kay do?
I think the theory that Torres sort of felt inhibited in the shadow of Drogba is entirely correct. But I think given a more regular run of games, given a team that is set up more to play to his strengths, we will see more from him. But I would say that they do need more cover up front. I'm surprised really that they let Lukaku go out alone.
There is a 30-second limit on this, Kay. Just so we're clear on that. So the answer is yes, buy another striker. Swansea are top of the table after 5-0 shellacking of Queen's Park Rangers. Cass, did you expect Laudrup to start so well? And you're evidently as big a fan of Michu as I am. Mm. Huh? 15 league goals in La Liga, £2 million. Pretty sweet.
Absolutely.
Moneyball.
I said to Rory over the weekend, £2 million for a striker, 15 goals in La Liga. Absolute bargain. He's still got to prove he can do what he did on a regular basis. But the way he took his second goal, okay, he was gifted the first by Robert Green. I thought he's finished. finish was just typical of a striker. Instant, not even thinking, predator instincts, bends it in the top corner, left footed, and I thought it was a marvellous goal. And I tell you what, for 30 minutes they were second best against QPR and could easily have been losing the game, and yet as the game wore on, every chance they got they took.
He's interesting because he's a big dude, but he's not really a traditional centre forward. He can play in the hole, so many different things he can do. Fulham beat up Norwich, winning 5-0, and Clint Dempsey plays no part. Rory Dempsey, who I think is a warrior of the light, revealed on Twitter that the truth would come out. I can't wait that long, so tell me, what happened? Now, I'm assuming that you know. If you don't know, I can't really tell you because I don't know what I'm supposed to say and not say. So go ahead.
I don't know in detail, but I think what's happened is that Dempsey was told by Liverpool that they were interested. Dempsey went and told Fulham that Liverpool were interested and he would not be returning. And then the deal failed to materialise. Dempsey's essentially, I don't think he's gone on strike, but Martignolle has decided that you need to be committed to Fulham to play for them. Because obviously all footballers who play football for any football clubs are extraordinarily committed at all times. And Dempsey is now training on his own at Motspur Park. I think that is a terrible shame. I think Clint Dempsey is a warrior of the light. He's a lovely bloke and he's a brilliant footballer. And to be honest, the biggest mystery for me in this is why Liverpool haven't made a bid for a player that Brendan Rodgers definitely wants.
Andre Villas-Boas gets another shot at Spurs, but goes down 2-1 at Newcastle. Ollie, any sense of whether he has learned from some of the mistakes he made at Chelsea? And what does he need to do?
I think he could not fail to have learned something from the Chelsea experience. I mean, man management-wise, he really struggled to deal with the English footballer and well, frankly, a lot of other nationality footballers. But I think he will have had his eyes opened by that experience. He will be approaching this in a different way and be antagonising people less, maybe being a little less aloof. But whatever people might think of Harry Redknapp, Villas-Boas has got big shoes to fill and a hard act to follow. And Saturday showed it's not going to be easy.
So much for second season syndrome. It's a big win for Newcastle. And frankly, if Hatem Ben Arfa keeps playing this way, you wouldn't bet against them challenging for the top four, would you? Cass, you're the biggest Francophile here, seeing as to Rory has this weird Uruguayan fetish and all these world centers around Rippenden. So please tell us, will the Franco tune delight us all again?
Well, I tell you what, it was a real pleasure watching the game because I thought that certainly Ben Arfa was absolutely running the show, pulling all the strings, enjoyed Newcastle. I thought their momentum of last season, the hunger and desire they showed from before, because Tottenham were there for a while. It was a pretty evenly matched game, but got to say Newcastle just carried on from last season for me, and I thought Alan Pardew has done an incredible job there.
See, Alan, I told you we'd get through the entire show without mentioning you pushing the limestone. Oops.
Gabriele, one for you. Your mate Carlo Ancelotti, warrior of the light, spent more money than anyone else in the entire world this summer, buying, among others, Ezequiel Lavezzi, Thiago Silva, and Zlatan Ibrahimovic, who's apparently some sort of striker. He's failed to win both of his first two games. Is he really a rubbish manager? Should he be sacked?
Well, if it continues like this, I would imagine he will be on his way. 2 points in two games isn't good. I think the issue right now is just, he just has a lot of bodies in the camp. They have an enormous squad. They played against Ajaccio at the weekend, and there's only one of the new signings actually played. And they were, they wasted chances. Lavezzi got sent off. Ancelotti himself got sent off for kicking a water bottle. Weren't helped by some of the refereeing decisions. The point is, there are several levels this team needs to go to. That's all we've got time for this week. It's been fun. It's been real. Come find us on Twitter to share your thoughts, or you can email gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. You can also go to thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, our web chats. Rory's web chat is on Mondays, which means by the time you download this, you just have to plan ahead for next Monday. Mine, of course, is on Tuesdays. Ollie, yours is?
Wednesday.
Wednesdays, as ever. And as I mentioned, in addition to our web chats, we're all on Twitter, so hit us up. We love to chat, especially Cass. Till next time, bye-bye.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.